Welcome to Keep Making Movies, the podcast where we explore, shall we say, movies that may have needed a bigger budget. We evaluate the movie for what it is, decide if it could have been improved with a budget, and if it'll join our Keep Making Movies official recommend list. I'm your host, KJ, and with me is...
Tom.
Today we are discussing James Ward Burkitt's Coherence. This is James Ward Burkitt's second feature-length film, following a TV movie called Stop at Nothing, three shorts, and a video game. In Coherence, we follow a group of friends who have gathered for a dinner party on a night that a comet's going over. The power goes out, and they try to explore around the town, and they realize every house they go to is also their house, and there seems to be other versions of them, but they're very confused, they don't know why, and they're trying to figure it all out. By the end, our main character gets to choose which version of her friend she wants to live with, and attempts to commit murder to do that, and then we fade to credits. So Tom, James Ward Burkitt made this movie. What do you think his goals were? Why do you think he chose to make this movie?
His goals, it appears, were to make a pared-down film, and based upon the interviews I've read from him, to draw from theater in order to create an improvised type of thing. So he wanted to have a kind of bare bones film. And the plot seems to be designed so that he can have one set. And we should maybe talk about what the Schrodinger's cat stuff and all that. And we'll get into that.
That's a very big part of the movie. Yep.
Yeah. And we'll get into that. But I think basically the plot is designed so that wherever they go, they come back to this one room, this one house, but really most of it's filmed in this one room, and they're in the living room.
Right.
And so the focus of the film, I think, is on the technique. It's not on evaluating, at least I don't think, some kind of profound philosophical concept, even maybe if he finds that interesting or that's kind of a sideline. I really think it is, how can you make a compelling film with as little as possible? I don't know, KJ, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think he had two goals, and I think you absolutely described the one goal, the minimal crew, the improv. I think part of that also is he wanted to see what would happen if the actors were learning the plot at the same time as the audience.
Yes.
I think that was one of his goals. And then I think his second goal was to tell this small sci-fi story about quantum entanglement and Schrodinger's cat, which I think both are fun ideas. I just don't know if doing them at the same time was a good idea.
Why do you think that?
I think if you wanted to test the improv grounds and the minimal crew grounds, have a simpler plot that would be a little bit either easier to follow or doesn't leave room for confusion. Or if you wanted to tell the quantum entanglement story, do that with a script with clear roadmaps and guidelines and just more obvious ways to have clues as to exactly what's going on.
My problem actually with this movie is I think a little different from yours. And I think this, it's kind of interesting because I actually had no problem following the messiness of the movie. I think in part maybe because the messiness of the movie, following the exact details the way you might with a film like Primer, it doesn't really matter very much, right? Like, I don't think when Hugh's windshield is broken, the fact that we have to follow exactly when that happened matters, you know, or
you're
how many
right.
notes, you know, right. there's one
were,
scene.
When did the box come in and out of the house? Who was carrying what glow stick?
Mm-hmm. And it's actually, I think part of the problem is that these facts kind of don't add up to much. And we should maybe say something about what the hell's going on.
Sure.
Yeah. So the inspiration for this movie seems to be the Schrodinger's cat problem in quantum mechanics, which is moved from quantum mechanics into a sort of a philosophical statement. And the idea is there is a cat in a box, and there is either a bit of gas that's going to kill the cat about to be released, or a gun, whatever, some sort of device that will kill the cat. And what triggers the device is based upon the particular position of a single particle. If we're in quantum mechanics, quantum decoherence is, quantum coherence is when a particle is in a superposition. It's not in a single position. It's in every possible position. Schrödinger's point is
the cat's alive and dead.
The cat is alive and dead, right? Because normally we would say this kind of quantum mechanics stuff is about the very small individual particles. But when you add this kind of construct to the position of the particle, it makes it absurd, right? It creates an absurd situation. In this movie, a comet flies overhead. That makes the quantum, the Schrodinger's cat occurrence happen. And so these characters are now in a world where there is a bunch of houses, and not even a bunch of houses. It seems to be an infinite amount of houses, possibly.
Right. Like, yeah, theoretically it's every possibility for this movie, we'll say.
Yeah. Which isn't exactly quantum mechanics, whatever. That's the title is coherence, is that what has happened during this night is that there's a bunch of that basically all these people are now in a superposition vis-a-vis one another. The danger, maybe, where the threat comes in, is that these states, once the comet passes, will collapse upon each other and we will have a definite state. I.e., if you open the box and see if the cat's alive or dead, the cat now becomes either alive or dead. It's not both.
Yeah, but the movie didn't really do that, right? Because the end of the movie is our main character waking up the next day and there's coherence, but at no point did they consider that threat, right? The closest they get to that is they start to read the book from the guy's brother. and audience, so I had watched this a year ago, and Tom was watching this, and I'll call it live tweeting directly to me, and he had some really funny questions and comments. One was, thank God that brother's dude has a book.
It's one character. His brother happens to know about all this stuff and gave him a book, which is in his car. So we have a book to read to explain it.
And the reason it's in the car is because his wife didn't want it on the shelf or something. Right? It was another.
Yeah, it's another thing. This is where the improv becomes kind of a problem, right? Because it's clearly they're just making up where this book came, how the book got in the car, and it's maybe not as interesting as like sitting down and thinking it through.
Well, so then I think they kind of play with that coherence by having the different groups of people. So one of the things that happens early on in the movie is two of the guys, I think it's Hugh and Amir, leave the house and then come back. And you don't know this, but they're actually different Amir and Hugh. They're not the same ones that left. They're starting to play with the different groups and having them interact with each other without the audience really knowing. And then when the reveal happens, it's still kind of confusing. But one of the tweets, it's not a tweet, audience, it's a message. I don't know why I'm calling it a tweet. One of the messages I got from Tom, let me just find it real quick. Oh, I actually don't know if I can say it on air here, but it's something along the lines of, in every universe, they're jerks. Like, there's no, part of the problem I kind of had with the movie was the conflict comes from the people aren't very nice to each other and think that if they're going to find another group, they're going to hurt the other group or the other group is going to hurt them.
Yeah, there is a manufactured conflict. The other houses do not demonstrate any kind of danger. I mean, at first, somebody bangs on the window and they're a little scared. But when they figure out what's happening, there isn't any reason why the other houses should be of danger to them or they to them.
Right? Nicholas, they could all come together and start singing Kumbaya and it should be fine because they're all
matter.
Right.
Like, yeah.
If you're hanging out with your friends and then you find out there was copies of your friends all over the place, why would you think they're a threat?
Why are you terrified? And they're also terrified, utterly terrified throughout the, like everybody is.
Yeah.
And so it's this bizarre thing where you're like, what are they worried about? And Nicholas Brandon's character, Mike.
Mike. Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
He seems to be like the one who starts implying we should get violent. Mike is a former actor, and he has apparently a drinking problem, and he's a little off. His career is sort of over or on stall, and he's the wild card. And apparently he is thinking about going over there and doing something violent. He decides he's going to blackmail himself so that the other house can't get the book and figure out what is happening. But we don't know why he thinks his alternative self is going to kill him. We have no, you know, we don't know where this comes from. And so this threat seems to be, and when they meet the other people, mostly it's fine, right? At one point, there's a main couple. There's Kevin and Emily, right? I think it is the main couple.
Yes.
And Emily meets alternative Kevin, and he's fine. He's actually nicer than her Kevin. he's a better Kevin. So, and she like backs away from him in shock, you know, like, oh, and you know, the music rises. Oh no, we're really scared. But like, the man is no threat whatsoever. It's the same guy. So the conflict seems manufactured. And I actually have a problem with how the characters interact even before the conflict arises. But I'd like to hear more from you, KJ.
Well, so pulling on that thread a little bit, Tom, I think that might also be the improv, right? My understanding is the director gave them all little note cards. So they also didn't know what the other people were improvising. And I on the Wikipedia, it said the director had a problem where everybody wanted to talk because there was no script. So nobody knew when they could talk. But you can imagine you have an opportunity to be in a movie. You know, that I don't know how many feature length films these actors are going to be in. So they're just going to talk and try to take over the scene. So one of the problems the director had to deal with was bringing everybody down to a level where there was coherent conversation. Which I don't know that they ever got there yet, but I'm ching, yeah, coherent, yep. I don't know that they quite got there. And I'd like to bring up Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is a TV show on HBO by Larry David, the creator of Seinfeld, which, very similar style, Larry's the writer, but he doesn't write a script. He just kind of knows what needs to happen in a scene and tells everybody. I mean, there might be an outline, and everybody kind of improvs the script knowing they need to get to a certain goal. And if you watch the first few seasons, it works. It's funny. It's comedy. It's not sci-fi. But as the show goes on, they get really good at it. I think if these actors were more practiced at improv for a movie, which I don't know how you do that without just making a bunch of movies, it may have been easier to digest some of the conversations they were having.
Yeah, I think of Adam McKay, who's done Anchorman and Step Brothers and those films, the Saturday Night Live writer who's done so much funny work with Will Ferrell. They shoot something like 1 million feet of film. They're just shooting all the time. And what you're seeing is the gold, right? These filmmakers don't have that opportunity because they have 5 days to make this. And they have very limited hours even within those 5 days. So there's that problem. Also, it seems like the really good improv stuff, when it's pure improv, right? I mean, not like little improv moments, but a pure improv thing, seems to work better with comedies than with tense dramas.
Imagine going to an improv club and it's drama night.
Oh, yeah, right? Like, why be? That actually seems like a really funny concept for an improv. It's having to be like one up each other on how serious the situation is. Yeah. And so I guess that's a really good point. It's like everybody's trying to butt in and talk. And some of the problems with this is, as you're pointing out, that he can't like temper these characters. But they also start not acting like human beings would act. And this is even before the comet passes over and the conflict occurs. I mean, one of the premises, one character named Amir brings a date, Lori, to this party. Lori is the ex-girlfriend of Kevin, the main character, who is there with his longtime girlfriend, Emily. So for some reason, Amir is so dull to how to behave like a human being to his friends that he does this. The explanation we're given is, that's so Amir. But we get very little else out of Amir, and we don't know why he would behave in this way, or why Lori would go to this party, or anything. So you have these people because the director has told them you have this conflict, but they don't have a justification for it, that they sort of have to on the fly explain why they're not acting like friends would act.
Right.
And naturally, as actors, they're leaning into pursuing the objective, overcoming the conflict, which just creates more conflict, which doesn't make any sense. Because if I was friends with Amir for a long time, like, you know, if you were single and, you know, you brought my ex-girlfriend to a party, that would be super weird. Mm-hmm. You would not do that. I would not do that to you.
Right.
We wouldn't even think of it. It wouldn't be like, it's okay, Jay, you know. So you have, and it's like the movie's filled with things like that.
Yeah. And it's almost stuff that might work improv night for comedy, right? Oh, that's mm-hmm. funny. He brought the ex. Think of the amount of jokes we can pile on top of that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems to be, well, we need an ex-girlfriend to come between Kevin and Emily.
And Emily, right.
You know, but even we're not even sure why. I mean, at one point, Laurie, that this is the ex-girlfriend, does get Kevin to kiss her,
yep.
which also is bizarre. Like, he's not drunk. Like, why would, you know, even if he finds her intriguing or sexually interesting, like, is he an idiot? His girlfriend's right in the other room, you know? Why would he act like this? So it's very strange, and it's not at all convincing. I think of all the characters, the one who has the most definite, actually, personality, I think, is Nicholas Brandon's character, who plays
the actor.
Yeah, the actor. And he's a bit of a jerk. You know, he's a bit, his impulses don't exactly make sense, but he is like a distinct person, more so than the other ones.
I think my favorite line from him at the very end, he says, I wish we could roast marshmallows on that meteor.
Yeah. It's, yeah, some, yeah, well, maybe not his best improv. Yeah. Another thing I want to talk about too, and I'm interested because, KJ, I think you've seen more of this type of low budget science fiction movies than I have, is the opportunity to explore an interesting idea, which I think science fiction does probably even more than fantasy, right? I mean, it's kind of impossible to say what is fantasy and what is science fiction, but it seems to be things I think of as science fiction tend to explore interesting ideas more than fantasy.
Sure. Original Star Trek, Twilight Zone. Absolutely. Mm. Yep.
Yeah. I even think like Star Wars, even bad Star Wars, like The Phantom Menace, is exploring these kind of new worlds and whatnot and these political systems.
Don't worry, audience. I know Star Wars is fantasy, even if Tom thinks it's sci-fi.
Okay. Fair enough. Space Wizards. Even episode one of Space Wizards is a little bit. But anyway, so typically what ends up happening is I think the exploration turns out not to be very interesting. And I think that's the case with this movie as well. In our text chain about this, I thought of the very famous play, Waiting for Godot, in which you have a situation which we could also think of as a low budget. Just two people standing in front of a tree waiting for a guy. And it's an absurdist situation because the day just keeps repeating over and over again. And at one point, the tree magically changes. But it felt something like this, where you're kind of stuck in the same room, in the same space. In the case of Waiting for Godot, they can't leave because they're waiting for Godot. In this case, they can't leave because wherever they go, it's the same place again. In Waiting for Godot, it explores this kind of idea of the static, and like the human condition really is not how we see it in realistic movies, which might be melodramas or about, you know, a rom-com or something like that. But really this absurd situation reveals the human situation, which is most of our days are kind of exactly like every other day, right? Like, you know, we live in, like, tomorrow is kind of going to look a lot like today. And we can't get out of that rut. And so they're able to bring something kind of profound about the human condition through this absurd situation. We get something like that here. We have these people who are trapped in an absurd situation, one prompted by science fiction, but still an absurd situation. And what conclusions do we learn about the human animal from this?
Well, so going back to the original series of Star Trek, I think some of the best episodes don't try to answer the question. They just try to pose the question and give you some information to help you maybe determine what you want, right? They don't leave you high and dry. They don't just leave the question and run. There's always both sides. There's usually you're presented with the first side and it makes it so you agree with that completely. And then they show you the other side and you're like, oh, gee, maybe I agree with that one. But I agree. I think the problem that Coherence had was it was too complicated of an idea to do in improv. Coherence and quantum entanglement is tough to tackle when the actors don't know what's coming next.
Yeah, I suppose, like, I don't, I think the, I don't, I still, the idea is kind of like, it's still a multiverse idea, right? A brief multiverse, but, you know, it's not a very long lasting multiverse, but still the same ideas we see in multiverses. In our other show, we did Everything Everywhere All at Once, which I think deals, I certainly have my problems with that movie, but I think it deals with the multiverse in a very intelligent way. And in a way that's actually kind of philosophically rich, you know, with some action movies, maybe not as much. So I don't find the idea that complex. There's every possible universe or most possible universes are out there.
No, but the details of this instantiation of that idea was challenging instead of either obvious or, you know, lead us through it, right? Everything Everywhere All at Once, they bring up that picture of the low resolution map to say, oh, you're slingshotting. And once you see that map, oh, it clicks. You get it. You understand. Here, there was like the different color glow sticks. Okay, that was a little bit helpful, but no payoff, except sometimes they'd hold up the two different colors. It's like, no, look, there's definitely multiple people here. There was the box with the numbers, the pictures, and the items that identified themselves. But all that kind of just added to the confusion, not clarified. It wasn't subtle cues to string you along. It felt like an important plot piece because there wasn't much else plot. There wasn't much else going on in the plot, but then if you tried to figure it out, you're like, well, I don't remember what numbers they said at first, right?
Yeah,
that picture was off by a little bit. I mean, I trust you, you're saying it, but it's
I'm not going to retain that detail,
right?
Yeah, I see.
So I think if they just fell on one side or the other, either do the improv experiment or do the sci-fi. But to go back to your original question, you know, does the movie provide any answers to the quantum entanglement experiment that it's doing?
Or any intelligent speculation, even?
I don't think so. But this actually brings us to one of our favorite questions on here. Would a budget have helped this film? Do you think a budget could have helped answer those questions? In other words, if he had either more time, and maybe more schedule is what he needs, not more budget. But if he had more time, either more sets or more props. I don't mean like fill it with props, but more intentional props. So more of a budget to refine what that was. Maybe there could have been more speculation about what it would be like to be the cat.
Yeah, I think the benefit of having more budget would be more filming days, not more effects or locations or whatnot. Because the singleness of the location is important, though. Like film in a bedroom or something. We have the whole house. But I think what you would have is if you did this sort of Adam McKay, let's film a million feet of film, let's put it, you know, put that out there, or we have the time to do that. And spend 30 days instead of 5 days just filming, doing the scene over and over again, and then cutting together the gold, maybe that would help. I don't think it would hurt.
Well, even the living room, let's say we just stuck in the living room, establishing shots, distinctive couches, pillows, and maybe the pillows changed, and that's how we know they're changing houses. You know, you do kind of subtle, more subtle stuff. Like, to compare James Ward Burkett to Steven Spielberg, I think Spielberg may have established the house more. We would have known the house maybe even before we knew any of the characters. And I think knowing that space may have put us more at ease and made it easier to digest what was going on.
I don't think you're wrong. No, I think the space isn't clear of where the house is, what the house, we don't know what the house looks like. We only have that living room, the kitchen, a bit of the bathroom. But the next day
Which I guess is tough to do, right? It's not a set. What are you going to use, a wide angle light? Like, yeah,
I
what
mean
can you do? Yeah.
I guess so. I mean, you still have the problem of there isn't a problem, right? There isn't nothing's there's no thing that's going to hurt them. There's nothing that's coming for them. There's no villain. The villain is kind of made up. And that sort of gets us to the ending, I think, a bit too. Because, I'll answer the question before we get into the ending, because I think we should talk about the ending.
Great.
I would say that, I mean, I already answered the question, I guess, but I would say, in terms of reflecting what you said, yeah, I think that making the house a character would help a lot. And then maybe making the evil house a character as well. The evil house. They don't do anything evil there. Making that house a character as well would also be interesting. It would kind of loom as a threat. The problem, of course, you would have to still create an actual threat.
Well, so to create a threat, I kind of liked your idea of maybe if the characters were more aware of quantum mechanics one way or another. They read the book, they're all geeky scientist friends, I don't know. And if they were like, uh-oh, eventually this is all going to collapse. And then you bring the different houses together, all of them knowing it's going to collapse, then it can be like either a man versus nature or a man versus man. If some for some reason they believe if they kill the other ones, and then they'll be the one that doesn't get collapsed, right? That's one way they could have created conflict.
Yeah, that's true. That would be a good way to, like, somehow they get the idea that only one of them, one version of them, can make it. I guess you just have that. Maybe it's in the book also. It's, one version of each person is going to exist once this is all over. That would, and maybe the other house learns that earlier, so the threats start happening even before you know why. That would actually create a bit of a problem for them to have to overcome. Can we talk about the ending a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, let's jump into the ending. So the way the movie unfolds at the end is Emily leaves the house, and I'm trying to remember why now. Everybody's
She
mad.
they everybody's getting in a fight. Another note gets put on the window, and then she just leaves.
So she leaves, and she's kind of going house to house, and it's a pretty fun montage looking in the windows of all these other houses. In one house, they're all tied up. In one house, they're really mad at each other. In one house, they're just having a nice time, right? It's really nice. So she sneaks into that house, kind of makes a noise, somehow isolates the Emily from that house, drugs her, throws her in a trunk. Goes back into the house as Emily, realizes it's really wonderful, but then Emily too wakes up, comes in the house. So she smashes her head with the top of a toilet, shoves her into the bathtub. Then she passes out and she wakes up and it's all happy chappy until Kevin gets a call from Emily too. Cut to credits.
It seems as if the concept they're going for, which is eventually decoherence, right? Coherence turns into decoherence, where the box of the box with the cat in it is opened, doesn't really add up, because once the comet passes, whatever universe you're in, you're in. So they aren't going to collapse on each other. It's just, instead of accessing each other, they can no longer access each other.
Which I, that's one of the ideas in quantum mechanics and the entanglement is once the observer observes it, that's what collapses it, and that's now the reality. So I guess quantum entanglement doesn't preclude the idea that the cat does live and die. They're just in different realities. The one that you happen to observe is your reality. The observer is the reality, right? So I think that's okay that all the houses potentially survived, and now there's no Emily in that original
Yes,
universe.
I think that's fine too, but why is she so intent on getting, is it just that they're not fighting, so she thinks everybody's just better in that other universe.
I think that's what we're supposed to take away from that.
That's what we're supposed to take away.
She's choosing the best version of her friends, killing herself off.
And her evidence for this is they haven't figured out that the comet is creating this problem. Because it doesn't seem like these really good people are responding to the problem with support and mutual love. They just aren't aware of the problem. That's why they're not fighting.
Right. They're kind of acting like most people would if they lost power. Right. That's the first indication. I mean, the first indication is people's phones are breaking. But what really happens is they lose power, and for some reason, everybody freaks out in the original house. Whereas in this other house, it just seemed like, ooh, okay, well, we're just sitting and swap light stories candles. Like we normally do. Yeah, right. Yeah. Like
this shouldn't change anything.
Yeah.
You know,
pour the wine. Like, what's the right?
Yeah. And originally, the problem of losing power that sponsors this conflict of Hugh and Amir going to the other house is that Hugh's brother told him if anything weird happens to give him a call.
That's right.
And he can't. And so now they're in a panic because something weird happened, and so they have to call his brother, who may or may not be a college professor. They say he's neither a college professor and is a college professor, which maybe that's entanglement right there. But yeah, and so that's what gets them going to this other house, is that they have to call the brother because something strange happened. They lost power, you know, the strangest thing that ever happened to anyone. And they need to let him know that they've lost power. This guy who most of the people at the party don't know who this guy is. Yeah. Know.
Right.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, again, it's one of these things. I think you've mentioned this so many times at this point that it's just like, the improv doesn't naturally give us answers to these weird situations.
Yep. So Tom, does this make the Keep Making Movie list for you?
I'll be honest. I think the guy's, I don't know. I was, it seems like he knows what he's doing with a camera. He seems to know how to light a scene, how to edit it together. I think possibly it's not the best experiment in the world, but this man seems to know what he's doing. I think this looks more polished than a lot of the films we've seen on here.
I agree.
So I will give him, I won't recommend this movie, but I'll give him the thumbs up for future projects if anybody cares what I think.
Yeah, and for me, Tom, it's a yes. And I want people to keep experimenting. And I love that he's experimenting with the improv. I would love to see another movie by him with the improv without the quantum entanglement, right? Pick something that maybe we already know and then watch an interesting improv version of that. Or if he really likes the sci-fi stuff, make a movie that's a straight sci-fi movie. But like you're saying, he can light a scene. He can tell a story, right? This probably was not easy to edit together, right? The characters didn't know what was happening, so they could take it in any direction. It's probably like editing reality TV without the goal being marketing, right? Like it's pretty impressive that he did get the story to go as he did. Mm-hmm. So it's a yes for me. I'd put it right on the recommend list.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think that it's a coherent story that you can follow, and so forth. That's not really the issue. And you know, you have some. I think the Emily character, who's played by a woman named Emily, is interesting face, interesting actress. I mean, I'd like to see her in other things, you know, that type of thing. But yeah, I think maybe this story, with something more, and also something more enlightening about the actual quantum entanglement state. I mean, like what we get out of this is people in a, you know, every version of you is going to what, get angry at you or feel threatened by you if there's another version of you. or something like that. I mean, with Everything Everywhere and All at Once, we get this kind of like Sisyphusian problem where, nothing matters, but you have to find joy in the world in spite of that. And you find out through connection with family and whatnot. With Godot, we get like the true human condition is absurd. You're stuck in a place. Here we get people who are kind of seemingly fragile. When the power goes out, they get really fragile. I don't know. Maybe that would be a change to consider as well.
It's official. Coherence has made the list. So please, James Ward Burkett, keep making movies.
You can rate and review this show anywhere fine podcasts are available. For those viewing in YouTube land, if you haven't already, please like this video, subscribe to the Talking Studios channel for all our exciting content, and follow us on social media at Talking Studios. Check out other shows by Talking Studios, including Talking Pictures Trivia, where we explore movies through trivia, Limited Lexicon, where we play through text-based adventure games, Get the Point, where we slowly reveal a movie poster and try to guess which movie poster it is, and Adapt It, where we explore adaptations in various forms. Got a question for us? Call the Talking Studios hotline at 201-467-8679 and leave a message. It may be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Keep Making Movies wherever fine podcasts are found.
Next week, we'll be discussing Monster Seafood Wars. Tom, how was your watch?
This was a very hard watch for me. It's a movie that has this kind of one joke going for it, namely, imagine if the kind of monsters from the great monster movies, the Godzilla, Mothra, Rodan, what if we ate those monsters and they taste delicious? They became, which is really funny. It's a really, really funny idea. That idea gets touched on at about the halfway point in this film, and it kind of stops being an idea 10 minutes or 15 minutes later, and we go back to the inexplicable plot. So for me, a lot of the movie was just not confusing, but clearly the work of people with not very much money who thought the spirit of their venture, this kind of celebration of the kaiju film, would carry the day. And the plot doesn't really make a lot of sense. It's actually somewhat hard to follow, despite the plot not being overly complicated. Like, you're not entirely sure why people are doing the things they're doing. It's overlit in every instance. You wonder if they just turned on lights and just shown them everywhere. I guess the comparison I would be like is when Tommy Wiseau, who did The Room, which was unintentionally funny, decides to do comedy projects. And The Room is funny because he didn't mean to make a funny movie. Monster Seafood Wars, they're intending to make a kind of Ed Wood funny movie, or an Ed Wood movie that isn't supposed to be funny, but turns out to be funny. Yet they are doing this by design. And so the consequence of that is it feels harder to sit through, I suppose, as opposed to like an honest bad movie, which we can enjoy and celebrate for its sloppiness. KJ, what did you think?
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat, Tom. This was an 8 minute at a time movie for me just because I needed some breaks. Mm. I was so excited when I saw the poster and the title, right? Monster Seafood Wars.
Yeah.
And I was hoping for a corny Godzilla, but I think, yeah, I mean, some of the Godzilla movies are already corny. Turning it up to 11. Audience, watch this film. Don't watch this film. It's up to you. But tune in next week to hear what we have to say about it. Monster Seafood Wars is available on Prime Video at the time of this recording.
Wow, Talking Studios,